And under advisement. We move to the second case of the morning, as soon as everybody clears out. Second case is Central State Southeast versus the Kroger Company. Mr. Brenneman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Steve Brenneman. I represent the Kroger Company, the defendant appellant in this action. Your Honors, we respectfully request that this Court reverse the District Court's liability finding in favor of the plaintiffs, or in the alternative, reverse on grounds that the plaintiff's claims are barred by latches and the statute of limitations. Your Honors, to establish liability in this case, it was the fund's burden, given the prior litigation between the parties and this Court's prior decisions, to establish that Kroger did not intend to hire the employees at issue here on a short-term basis or to work from time to time. And to attempt to shoulder this burden of proof, the fund relied, and the district court found, district court based its holding primarily upon the testimony elicited from four hourly workers who were hired by Kroger in 1977, 1978, and 1982.
And these were workers, though, that had been with Kroger for, it was a combination of 80 years experience in the Atlanta warehouse, and they testified as to their hiring process and what they observed over a 16 to 22 year period at the warehouse, and the court found their testimony very credible.
That is correct, Your Honor, but my point, I guess, in response to that is that for all 82 or whatever of those years that the court found persuasive, all four were always hourly workers, and they admitted were never supervisors, were never managers, and therefore admitted did not speak for Kroger, and therefore could not comment on the critical question before the district court, which was Kroger's intent at the time of hire. And that's the fundamental problem with the district court's finding in this case, finding that the fund had established its burden of proof and met its burden of proof, because the evidence relied upon by the district court and advanced by the fund really showed what these hourly employees believed, hoped for, and aspired to in positions with Kroger.
And didn't it also show the reality of how they had been treated by Kroger and with respect to their status?
It
you know, because the intent, with all due respect to Kroger, I mean, there was, I think, some loose language used here when you look at the reality of what happened here versus what Kroger tries to characterize these workers as.
Well, the reality, certainly they did describe their experiences at Kroger, but what their experiences were, we submit, does not establish and does not enough to satisfy the fund's burden of proving what Kroger intended was in hiring not only these four workers, but hundreds of others over a very extended period of time. In addition to this testimony from these hourly workers about their hiring experiences, the district court also credited and relied heavily upon the fact that these workers supposedly received training from Kroger and that Kroger imposed productivity standards on the workers, supposedly showing that Kroger must have intended, with those things in place, must have intended these workers to be long-term regular workers. But we would submit, Your Honors, that the evidence was undisputed that as to the training and supposed nurture of these employees, that the evidence was undisputed that the training, which consisted of another hourly worker working alongside these new hires, included basic and fundamental sanitation and safety information that any employer would require of any employee, short-term, long-term, casual, or otherwise. Now, there was no dispute on that point.
In 1980, there was this Indianapolis hearing stuff. A lot of this stuff had to be brought up and discussed and negotiated and kicked around and whatever. What's the mystery here? There's always some determination that these people were in, I guess, progressive categories. Some people probably came in as whatever you want to call them, casual or part-time or something, and left before they were full-time.
Well, that's exactly the point.
And I assume they got calculated into this formula as well.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, because the evidence is undisputed, I think, that the vast majority of new hires by Kroger did, in fact, depart within a very short period of time. Again, I think undercutting the conclusion that the fund proved beyond a reasonable doubt that all new hires by Kroger were intended to be something other than casual.
Well, but then didn't the district court also look at the paperwork and how new hires were designated as casual employees, and that writing casual employees on all the applications of part-time employees, and the court found that that was really a camouflage for the true reason for showing that it was impossible to pick out from the background of those employees who was really designated as a part-time regular employee versus someone who was a casual employee. All of them were labeled casual. I mean, that was part of what the court looked at to reach that conclusion.
That is the evidence, Your Honor, and I would submit that it should compel the opposite conclusion, because that evidence, what Kroger manager wrote on the hiring documents, is the best or among the best evidence in this case about what Kroger's true intent was. They were the ones making the decisions. They checked casual status, and that's what, absent some other compelling evidence, we submit would be reflective of the company's intent. And mind you, that is buttressed by, in the fund's own case in chief, the testimony surrounding Reginald Davis, one of these four workers that I mentioned before. Mr. Davis, the evidence showed, was hired in 1982. The evidence was undisputed, that Kroger tendered Mr. Davis a document, an acknowledgement form, which bore his signature, which stated, I understand that I am being hired with a good possibility that this job will be terminated in April of 83, which was 5 months hence. Mr. Davis agreed that 5 month period would have been a short term stint as an employee of Kroger. This evidence has not been adequately addressed by the district court nor the fund in the briefs to this court. At best, the district court handled the evidence by saying simply that Mr. Davis didn't recall signing the document. But that is utterly irrelevant to the issue of Kroger's intent, which is embodied in the document which Mr. Davis admittedly signed.
What happens after the 5 months?
In practice, he did stay on. We acknowledge that he did stay on.
Yeah, there was a pattern that the district court found of that kind of designation of casual and individuals who stayed on for extended periods of time. And so, plus, there was a problem with the record keeping at Kroger, and the district judge drew a negative inference there, because there were certain documents in terms of accurate records of hours.
I don't believe there's any issue on records of hours, Your Honor, but what I think the district court was troubled by, as you've pointed out, is that the company designated every new hire as a casual. As I said before, we would simply urge this court to view that as evidence at the time of hire, which is what the prior litigation sets as the standard. That evinces Kroger's intent at the time of hire, that these people would all be casuals. Yes, some of them eventually did stay on. A very small percentage did stay on. But the critical
question... What is that very small percentage?
I don't recall from the record, Your Honor. I believe it's maybe less than 15% that eventually stayed on. Yeah, 15.
Stayed on for how long?
For what... probably all the parties here would agree would be something other than casual employment for a year or more.
A year or more. The casual definition was supposedly, a sort of a flexible type of hire. That seems to be maybe internally contradictory. For some people that were kind of on call, they'd come in, work for a while, and then not work, maybe in a real busy season, maybe they'd need the extras, and then they wouldn't be there.
Yes.
That's sort of what I would... Look, if you talk about casual versus part-time, where you have a designated 30-hour period of time. Maybe you have to come in at odd hours, but nevertheless, you're in a different category. And that seems to be where, and then the part-time people would advance on to full-time when there's an opening.
Well,
it seems that that's where I slip around here. I go back to 1980 because I thought in that Indianapolis, whatever you call it,
audit,
that everybody's aware of this problem here and they're trying to work out definitions and stuff. This isn't something that just happened.
You're right, Your Honor. Let me speak to that Indianapolis audit. That really goes to our affirmative defenses of latches and the statute of limitations. Before I get there, just a few more points on the evidence of the intent. You just mentioned what is a casual on call. It was clear in the record here that these employees were told by the Kroger hiring managers that they would be on call. They admitted that. They had no regular set hours. They were told they wouldn't get benefits. And some of them were told they would be fill-ins at busy times. So there is substantial evidence to support the finding that the district court didn't make, which is that they were indeed casuals. Now, with respect to our affirmative defenses, you've raised the Indianapolis audit. Yes, our position is that in 1980, the fund, and it's undisputed that in 1980, the fund investigated and audited a Kroger facility in Indianapolis under the same master collective bargaining agreement that applied in Atlanta. In that audit, as a result of that audit, or the results of the audit, have been destroyed by the fund over the years. They don't have any of the paperwork left over from that 1980 audit. The only fund representative that we could identify that was identified at trial who had any involvement in that audit was a very senior executive of the fund, Peter Prieta. Prieta testified that he had no idea, no recollection, no knowledge of anything that happened in that audit. He couldn't recall a thing. He admitted very directly. So what we have on the Indianapolis audit is the only evidence is coming from a Kroger accounting manager, Kevin O'Donnell. And there's been a lot of debate, both in the district court opinion and in the briefs to this court by the parties, as to what O'Donnell said, what he didn't say, where he was ambiguous, and where he wasn't. But I can tell you this, Your Honors, that it's clear in the record at least this much, that O'Donnell testified without contradiction that some Indianapolis employees labeled casuals for Kroger worked for more than a year in that status and were the subject of the Indianapolis audit, which the fund later capitulated on. Therefore, our position and our argument to this court, as it was below, is that in 1980, the fund knew that at least some people employed by Kroger, labeled casuals, were working for lengthy periods of time. And that should have put the fund on notice of the use of casuals in other Kroger locations, including the large Atlanta warehouse. So that is one of the arguments we've based our argument that both the statute of limitations began running in 1980 and latches has been satisfied. Let me speak back on the statute of limitations briefly. As Your Honors know, the ERISA section under which the fund brings this case does not contain its own statute of limitations. We acknowledge that in several prior decisions of this court has applied in this kind of a case the 10-year statute of limitations based on actions in Illinois for written contracts, violations of written contracts. The last of those decisions is the Gorman Brothers Ready Mix case decided in 2002. And in that case, the parties did not dispute the application of that 10-year limitation period. Nevertheless, both the majority opinion in Gorman Brothers and a concurrence by Judge Easterbrook made it clear that at least that panel believed there may be a better fit, a more suitable statute of limitations for this kind of a claim under ERISA. Your Honors, we have respectfully accepted the invitation issued by both opinions in Gorman Brothers to suggest to this court two better fits for a statute of limitations that should apply to this kind of a claim. The first limitation period we urge Your Honors to adopt is that the one applicable to claims under the Illinois Wage Payment and Collections Act. That is a five-year limitation period. And the reason that is the most analogous of any cause of action that could conceivably apply here is that that statute governs claims for wages and other compensation to be paid either to employees or to pension funds or other funds for the benefit of employees. Indeed, the statutory definition of supplemental wages expressly includes things like pension payments to pension funds. So it seems to us that that is clearly the most analogous action in Illinois, and that limitation period should govern.
If you're going to apply state law, that's what you would say, that's the way. Is that because it's a narrower than the general statute of limitations for contracts?
Not because it's narrow, but because it's the more analogous action, Your Honor. And that is the test that we
analogous
understand.
Meaning it's specific. I mean,
it's the most similar kind of claim embodied in state law, similar to the claims made here.
As opposed to just a general contract.
Correct. As I said, because the statute I'm talking about, the Illinois Wage Payment and Collection Act, specifically defines wages and compensation to include payments to pension funds. So that would be, we think, the best choice. An alternative, and we take no original authorship for these arguments, but the alternative we urge would be the statute of limitation contained in a different section of ERISA, and those reasons are articulated by Judge Easterbrook in his Gorman Brothers Ready Mix concurrence. A brief word, I see my light's on, and I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, but Judge Easterbrook pointed out in that concurrence the beauty of adopting this section of ERISA, the 1451F, and that would be that it would eliminate the need for this court, other courts, and from here on out, all other courts hearing these kinds of cases to debate and to discuss and to litigate endlessly these issues of latches or when the limitations period begins to run based on equitable principles such as tolling and the like, because 1451F includes and embodies a statute of repose which simply eliminates the need to discuss those things. And for those reasons, we would urge this court to reverse both on liability and on the statute of limitations, and I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Madden?
May it please the court, Albert Madden on behalf of the appellees. Under the applicable clear error standard, the district court's ruling that the Atlanta new hires were not casuals cannot be rejected because it's well supported by the evidence. This includes the ruling in Kroger 1 that there were no casuals in Atlanta from 1987 to 1989, as well as Judge Grady's finding that Kroger's casual defense was fabricated. The real reason for Kroger's non-payment on its new hires in Atlanta was an unenforceable oral agreement with Local 528 to exclude part-timers from participation in the pension fund. Despite a collective bargaining agreement that unambiguously requires contributions on part-time employees. Now, the judgment in the prior case was limited to the period of 87 to 89 because the parties agreed in their tolling agreement that the fund wouldn't expand their audit until that case was over. But absent evidence of a change before 1987 or after 1989, there's an inference that the employees hired during those periods were also not casuals and that the casual defense was fabricated for those periods too. At trial, the fund offered the testimony of the same four witnesses, employee warehouse witnesses, who testified in Kroger 1, and the deposition designations from Kroger 1 again of warehouse manager Donald Payne and the same documentary evidence offered in Kroger 1. All of this showed there was no change. What did Kroger do to prove there was some difference? Nothing. It stipulated that every document relating to the treatment of its new hires from 1977 to 1993 had been produced in the first lawsuit. Not a single Kroger management employee testified at the trial before Judge Guzman. In fact, Kroger called no live witnesses with respect to the issue of the treatment of the new hires in Atlanta. The only new evidence offered by Kroger was the deposition testimony of Jack Hogan, a retired manager, that consisted of less than 250 lines and indicated that there were no differences before 87 or after 89.
So you're saying that the Kroger one, as you refer to it, is sets the law in this?
I am, Your Honor. I am. And I think it sets both the law and the factual, there's a factual inference that it wasn't just out of the blue for 1987 to 1989 that every single employee hired by Kroger was not a casual employee. It's not just not that period of time. In the middle of the contract, the 87 to 89 period was just picked by the fund because our audits are typically three-year audits. Now, the testimony of the warehouse employees was described by Judge Guzman as most convincing. It established that when they were hired, the new hires were never told they were casual or temporary. They never heard the word casual used.
Now, the new hires in, as the Kroger's attorney said, and it seems apparent, is many new hires didn't stay a real long time.
That's correct.
And so there's a lot of turnover initially. Those that stay on, as with any case, they may end up long-term and they're dependable. But most people fall out, tired of carrying stuff around, couldn't make the quotas, whatever else reason. Do they come into this formula as well?
Well, there's a probation period in the contract, Your Honor, so that would exclude any of those people.
Anybody between 30 days and I guess a year or full time or something comes into this formula.
The way that the audit was calculated was we eliminated anybody who did not work for Kroger for a minimum of 12 weeks, 90 days. We used a 90-day cutoff in the audit. Anybody who hadn't worked 90 days was not included in the audit.
So over 90 and even less than a year, even though there may have been a whole lot, they would come into this formula, right?
Correct. And you would see from the audit findings that all of these people were working very regularly, many hours over that period of time. And in fact, when we used that cutoff, and then we backed down, after that we went back to the probation period. Anybody, we eliminated anybody who hadn't worked the 90 days, and then we assessed findings going back to after completion of the probationary period. And we found that 90% of our claim relates to employees who had worked over 1,000 hours for Kroger, and 80% of our claim relates to employees who were inevitably reported to Central States by Kroger.
And then did you do any math in terms of the proportion? You said you dropped out those that were 90 and less and kept all the 90 over so that we could get a sense, counsel, throughout the number 15% in terms of the number who ended up being full-time. Do you agree with that figure? Have you come up with a figure to just give us a sense of the proportion?
I don't believe there was any evidence in the record with respect to how many people were eliminated. My recollection is only from the other case, Kroger 1, where I think the number was approximately 75% of the people failed to work. We used the same cutoff in that audit, the same 90-day cutoff. Approximately 75% of the people failed to reach that cutoff period. But I think what's really important is what these people were told when they were being interviewed, and the four warehouse witness testimony is largely corroborated by Don Payne, the warehouse manager, and Jack Hogan. What they were being told was that they were part time. They were not being told they were casuals, and they were being
they
told
would not be told what.
I'm
you
sorry.
Said they would not be told what?
They would not be told they were casual.
All right.
They would not be told that they were temporary. They would not be told that there was any end to their employment. What they were being told, and every one of them was being told, that they would have the opportunity to qualify.
You don't think the union would bring people in to testify against each other, do you? I mean, let's be realistic.
I think they would testify honestly.
Well, I'm sure honestly, but they're prepared.
Well, And I'm not just saying these are the four warehouse employees. I'm saying this is Mr. Hogan.
We're talking about the warehouse employees, right?
These are the managers.
Right.
These are the warehouse. These are Kroger's management employees who no longer work for Kroger, who are testifying that when I interviewed these people, I told them that as long as they met our production and our attendance standards, they would inevitably be offered a full-time position as soon as there was an opening and they progressed up the chain. The other thing I think is very significant is these people were put on a seniority list, and Jack Hogan testified that they went on the seniority list from the day they walked in the door. Or at the latest, after they completed a 30-day probation.
They were all put on the seniority
list? That's what he testified.
When they walked in the door?
He testified that it was either when they walked in the door or after they completed the 30-day probation period. This is all, what was going on is all contrary to the contract because, in the first place, the contract says casual employees have no seniority rights. These people are put on a seniority list called the part-time.
What is binding then? The written contract or what?
The contract is certainly binding, but what they're trying to do is, and this is this whole issue of this fabrication of the defense, that what was really happening here is these people were all permanent part-time employees. Kroger knew it. The local union knew it.
The
local union. Pardon?
They're basically permanent until they left.
They're permanent until they left.
Because that's if you put it in that frame, these people frequently left.
They frequently left just as any test employee
would. Sure, and anybody who stays on, does good work, and likes the work and wants to go there, they obviously are going to be the people who, when there's an opening you want, they're tested, they're proven. So they're going to move into a permanent job.
Correct.
That's certainly business logic, and putting somebody on a seniority list means this is your probably starting date or something. So that's a list, and I guess there's rank among people who stay on a long time. It doesn't matter if you leave after a year because that seniority list won't mean anything. Yeah. But I don't know. I think what we're all trying to focus here is this clearly erroneous, or are these findings okay? And then I want to get into the statute of limitations also.
Okay.
But let me just get back. So there were no Kroger supervisors or managers who testified contrary to the former employees. Did I understand you correctly?
That's correct.
Because I didn't see that in the record.
That's correct.
So their testimony basically went unchallenged. Kroger had the opportunity to put on managers who were there at the time who could have said, oh, no, we told everybody they were casual.
That's
None
correct.
Of that happened.
That's
and
correct.
The people were put on the seniority list, and the contract says that casuals shouldn't be on the seniority list.
Correct.
Right. And their files were marked casual.
Their files, who did that, we don't know.
Right.
I mean, you have one thing saying somebody, an unknown person, mm-hmm. for an unknown reason, somebody probably in the human resource department checks the casual box. At the same time, somebody else is putting them on the part-time seniority list. The interviewer is telling them that you're part-time and you will inevitably become full-time as soon as you progress up this seniority list, despite the fact that the contract says that casual employees have no seniority rights. What's really happening here is exactly what the first case was all about. The exclusion of these people, the failure to pay contributions, has nothing to do with the casual definition of the collective bargaining agreement. And that's where this whole pretext finding.
Are these casual workers paying union dues?
I don't know. It's Georgia. It's a right-to-work state. There was no evidence on that. I honestly don't know whether they were or not. But what's
that part-time?
Are they part-time employees?
No, I said, are the part-time workers paying union dues?
I don't know, Your Honor.
All right.
Again, Georgia's a right-to-work state.
Is that an element of their contract with the union that they must pay them?
It's a right-to-work state, so the employees can't be forced to pay the union dues.
So it isn't an element of the contract?
It is in the contract. There are some dues provisions, but they can't force them to pay union dues.
What do you mean there are some dues provisions?
The contract does encourage.
What?
The contract does encourage the employees to pay union dues.
It encourages them?
Yes. It doesn't require it.
And they're not forced to join the union?
No, they're not forced
to
join.
So if they don't join the union, they don't pay the dues?
That would be correct.
Aren't you just, didn't you just say the opposite? That they're encouraged to pay the dues either way?
Sure, the union's always trying to lobby to get people to pay the union dues. They always want to.
Whether they join the union or not, they're encouraged to pay dues.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
That's what I wanted to get.
But again, union membership has nothing to do with coverage under the contract. And again, I think the key thing here is that these people were promised, here's the door to permanent employment. You just have to come in, you just have to keep your nose clean, and show up and do your job, and you will inevitably be full-time.
Doesn't there have to be an opening for them?
And there would have to be an opening.
There has to be an opening before they can take that permanent position.
That's correct. And I think Kroger gets into an awkward position when they're arguing that they never intended a single employee to be a permanent full-time employee over a 16-year period during a time when the size of the warehouse workforce increased from 144 employees to 372 employees. It just can't be. And ultimately, with respect to this issue of whether these employees are not the finding that these employees are not casuals by the district court, we don't think there's any way that Kroger can show that that finding was clearly erroneous.
And so what's your best argument, turning to the latches claim and whether the claims are barred by latches? What's your best argument?
Well, there's a lot of arguments with respect to latches. The threshold issue is whether the defense should even be recognized in an ERISA case. We don't believe that it should be. And this court indicated in the first Kroger decision that was an open issue. And you know, we see these defenses in virtually every delinquent contribution case that we file. Here, Kroger is simply rehashing the rejected estoppel defense from